Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 907. This episode brought to you by Loot Crate. Hey, you know, listen, maybe you want to be the envy of your friends. You want to get 100% exclusive crates at lootcrate.com/nerdist and then enter the code Nerdist to save 10% off any new subscription. October's Loot Crate theme is mythical. This is epic gear, housewares, collectibles, things you can wear, anything. It's a surprise, but you know it's coming and you know it's worth more than the less than $20 a month you're going to spend on it. Monthly wearables and accessories with cult classics and your favorite franchises. So offer expires October 19th, 9 p.m. Pacific. You hear the stories, you hear the whispers, the creatures, beings beyond imagination. Let us peer into the shadows together for mythical October's Loot Crate theme. You're going to get stuff from Marvel, Ghostbusters, Stranger Things, Buffy. One lucky subscriber will win a mega crate of seriously epic proportions. Again, you have until the 19th at 9 p.m. to subscribe. That's Pacific time. Go to lootcrate.com. Enter the offer code Nerdist to save 10% off any new subscription. Let's go to the Nerdist Community Corkboard. Brandon writes, a longtime friend of mine and I recently started a puppet comedy called Holy Baloney about two dudes who work in a sandwich shop. Very autobiographical. And there's a little smiley emoticon. We post 60-second shorts on our Instagram and archive on our YouTube channel, looking to extend our reach for viewership. Give a gander if you've got a free moment to like or scratch your head. Find us on Instagram at Doki, D-O-K-I, underscore, D-O-K-I, underscore, fun. Also, just a reminder, Best Friends Animal Society Strut Your Mutt coming up in October. They brought back Team Nerdist. This is a dog walk fundraiser that also includes photo booths, food trucks, free goodies, and much, much more. We have Team Nerdist in the past, and they are always a lot of fun. We're hoping to raise even more money for homeless pets this year. This year's LA event is October 21st at Exposition Park. We'd love to have you come out and strut your mutt with us. Or if you can't make it, you can always donate to our team. All the money from the team participants and donations goes to helping save homeless animals. Visit nerdi.st. That's the Nerdist URL shortener. /strutyourmutt2017. There you go. To find out more info, join the team, donate, go to that website. And then also, Nerdist Podcast alum Chili Gonzalez sent me an email. He says, I've launched a nonprofit, all expenses paid musical workshop called the Gonservatory. I will bring 6 musicians, 18 or older, to Paris next April and spend a week with them. Not just pianists or classically trained people, by the way. And he really just wants to spread the joy and the, what did he call it? The emotional science of music. It sounds amazing. There is an announcement video, which you can absolutely check out. If you just search for the Gonservatory, Gonzervatory, on YouTube. And it's on Chili Gonzalez's YouTube page. So there you go. Go do that. Be musical in France. I mean, come on. Why would you not want to do that? Why would you not want to do that? This episode is Ron Perlman returning for a third time because I adore him. He's promoting the new season of Startup. It's a series called Startup on Crackle. All the episodes are on crackle.com. Perlman is a phenomenal guest, and not just a phenomenal guest, but just a dude you want to fucking hang out with. And I'm so fortunate that I get to hang out with him. But Ron came to my house. Turns out we don't live that far from each other, so now we're going to get to hang out. And before you ask anything, no, I did not ask about Hellboy, so please spare me the, I can't believe you didn't ask about Hellboy. So many times people can't believe I don't ask for stuff, but believe it, because it's the reality. It just didn't seem – listen, millions of people have talked about it. They've bugged him about it. He doesn't have anything to say about it. He you look at his most recent AMA, he just said he didn't really have anything to say about it and didn't want to talk about it. So, you know, that's why I didn't do it. And but that being said, we had an amazing conversation about a million other things. He has some great Marlon Brando stories, and he's just a guy you want to spend a lot of time with. I'm going to stalk you, Ron Perlman. We're going to be friends, goddammit. I'm going to come to your house and borrow sugar. And even though I don't need sugar, I'm just going to keep borrowing sugar. And then I'm going to come in for a little sugar, if you know what I mean. So this episode, Ron Perlman, also brought to you by Stamps.com. Yes, the post office is a sucky experience as a consumer. Because it's just, there's long lines. And a lot of people don't even really know how the mail works anymore. Right? Because they're so used to that electronic mail. They don't know how IRL mail works. Someone came up to April Richardson in a post office, a young girl, and said, quote, how do I mail something? Legitimately. April had to tell her how to get a stamp, put it on, where to put it. Stamps.com just lets you buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, package, class of mail. You click print, mail, you're done. Your kind mail carrier comes and picks it up from you. You don't have to leave the house. You can stay a shut-in if you want to. And Stamps.com never closes. 24/7 you can do this. Plus, they're going to send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage, help you decide the best class of mail for your needs. Even get discounts you can't get at the post office. All the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. Right now, enjoy Stamps.com with a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com. Click the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. Here's the Nerdist podcast number 907 with Mr. Ron Perlman. Katie, roll the Perlman.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Very reticent. Do you have water? You need anything else? You good?
Got any cocaine?
Oh man, I don't know. It's not the 80s.
Wait, what?
I'm sorry. Did no one tell you it's not the 80s? Bitches. What was 80s Ron Perlman doing?
Them bitches they don't tell a person nothing.
Besides Beauty and the Beast, what is 80s Ron Perlman doing?
80s was Beauty and the Beast, baby.
Yeah, but besides that, what
you just say Beauty and the Beast?
I did. Yeah, but I meant
is that
like,
where I heard it?
You did hear it, yeah.
I heard it here first.
You were on the show called Beauty and the Beast.
Ladies
do you remember
and germs.
It? Do you remember it?
Vaguely.
Which
one was I?
You were. Oh boy, that's a great question. I could have been either, depending on the point of view.
Linda Hamilton's back in the Terminator.
Linda Hamilton's back in Terminator.
How freaking can I say fucking?
Yes.
How freaking cool is it?
I like that you backpedaled.
She is. She is such a dear human.
That's awesome.
I'm so happy for her.
That's going to be great.
Yes.
That transformation between Terminator 1 and Terminator 2 was spectacular.
It was, man. It was. And then what happened? But anyways.
Hey, everybody.
The 80s.
So what
was
is
the 80s Studio 54?
No, that was 70s.
See, I get it.
Sunset all. Strip was 80s.
Which was the Joe DiMaggio years?
Those were the
days, my friend. We thought they'd never. I'm sorry.
Are you still karaoke?
Did I hurt your ears there?
No, Katie's fine.
An adorable little engineer here. Are you as adorable as they say? No, are you? You are the engineer, right?
She's the engineer and the producer and the. Yeah, cool. She does everything.
She does the catering.
She does the She does that. She does some light therapy. She'll listen to all your problems. She's a good sounding board.
You know, if you're gonna be the all the things that he just described you as on a podcast, you better do a little therapy.
I feel like Katie. Boy, it'd be so interesting to find out. Like, do you go to a therapist and go, oh, and then I had to listen to these fucking assholes? No.
How do you purge?
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. That's part of what he has to do is listen to the stuff that you get.
So he
you.
Goes to therapy, obviously.
they have a lot of comfort animals.
It's so good to see you, man.
It's good to see you, too.
Long.
I know. What have you been up to besides this Crackle series and randomly seeing you at premieres?
Oh, God. I don't know. Pick a topic.
What... is your favorite Sunday? What's Ron Perlman's perfect Sunday? What do you do when you get up in the morning?
I like to go to the gym on Sunday.
Nice.
Because it's only amateurs in there on Sunday. And I love watching people drop weights on themselves. And spill sports drinks on their perfectly ironed... running pants.
Do people do people who irons their running pants?
That's what I mean. That's it. You only get that on a Sunday in the gym. So I go to the gym.
Yeah.
Hang on, I'm not done talking about
I'm
me.
Sorry, I apologize.
I thought that was
your whole day.
You ask me a question? No, that's just how it starts. No,
okay.
I actually get up hours before the gym.
Because
I'm suddenly I can't sleep anymore. I wake up like 5:30, 6 o'clock and I tweet for an hour or two.
Yep. Very healthy.
Watch some news. Get more ammo for tweeting. Get angry and angry and angry. When I get my blood pressure up to about 190 over 107, mm-hmm. I go to the gym.
And work it out.
And I try to see if I can bust a vein in my forehead.
And then after
otherwise
the gym,
known as an aneurysm.
I think that's what they call that. Yeah, I think that's what they call that. And then after the gym.
Boy, you're going to have some stuff for your boyfriend when I get finished with you.
He's really going to have an earful tonight. Poor Anthony's going to have a blower.
Oh, Tony, yo.
Hey, Tony. Do you ever call him Tony?
No.
You only call him Anthony?
Hey, Tony.
Yeah.
Try calling him Tony.
Just try it. Just go home tonight and go, hey, Tony. Just see what he does.
And then give me a call.
I'm just curious. I'm just curious to see if he accepts it or if he's like.
He's confused.
Would he?
Yeah.
Do you think he would think that you were seeing someone else? Like, you just called me the wrong name.
No, oh, Jesus. When he was, like, 13, he, like, had a month where he, like, went by Tony. Like, and I asked him, and he's like, yeah, I tried it, and I hated it.
Didn't like it.
Yeah.
What about Ronnie? Does anyone call you Ronnie? Hey, Ronnie.
A few people do.
Hey, Ronnie. What's up, Ronnie?
I went through a very long period where I used to bristle when I heard people call me Ronnie.
Yeah.
Because it was like... Was it with you where I talked about my life in psychotherapy?
I don't, probably, but maybe not. Are you seeing other podcasts?
No, I mean, I never heard of Marc Maron or Michael Rappaport.
Well, if you're talking about psychotherapy, it might have been Maron. It was probably Marc Maron.
Yeah, no, I think it might have been in my book. But anyway, Ronnie was the name of my shadow.
Okay.
Has anybody ever talked to you about it? The shadow?
No.
Of Carl Jung?
No.
I think Carl Jung invented the shadow.
All right. Let's hear it.
So the shadow is that helpless, ugly, completely to be shunned at all costs, little private secret place in you.
Okay.
That makes you have the worst self-esteem.
Okay.
And in the psychotherapy of Carl Jung, as given to me by Phil Stutz, the main centerpiece of this therapy is to identify the shadow and then become its parent and take care of it and nurture it and tell it that it has absolutely nothing to worry about because you will protect it and love it unquestionably forever.
Okay.
And in so doing, you make him beautiful. This very thing that you couldn't. So my shadow was Ronnie because all those years when the shadow was like, you know, not just a radio show.
Yeah.
But, you know, a state of being, everybody was calling me Ronnie. Now, when people call me Ronnie, and I'm 67 years old, and I've been through so much therapy and made so much peace with my shadow, I love people who call me Ronnie because it's like a real endearment. You know, it's like Ron is the professional guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and Ronnie is like,
you squeeze him, you're so low.
So cute.
He's adorable.
He used to be this ugly little shadow, and he blossomed into a beautiful Ronnie.
He's not in the shadows anymore.
That's nice. He's the goal is to grow the shadow up and nurture it and make it. Are you supposed to merge the shadow with yourself, or do you keep it separate? How's that?
Well,
work?
It is yourself.
It is, but it's a.
But it's the part of yourself that you found that you didn't want to associate yourself with.
Okay.
And by identifying it. And becoming its benefactor, best friend, parent, and guardian,
mm-hmm.
you have made peace with it in a way that is very, very proactive, and that causes it to no longer have this hold on you, where you've actually turned it into something loved and beautiful.
That sounds interesting.
Because everything that's loved is beautiful. Like the minute you love, the minute something is loved, all of a sudden they're not as quite as defensive and self-protective.
Right.
Don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it strengthens and comforts and then you don't feel alone. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's feeling alone. And when something's loved, it's not alone. But I guess you have to love yourself, and that's a very hard thing to do.
Well, yeah. Perry, that's the oracle. That's the Greek oracle. The Greek oracle is know thyself.
Right.
But it should be know slash love thyself.
Which is a, which, you know, unfortunately can take years to figure out how to do that.
And either of them are, both of them are equally daunting.
So you're
that's not what I'm here to talk about.
Yeah,
let's talk about showbiz.
It's full of little shadows, full of ugly little shadows who hate themselves.
Let's talk about showbiz.
What do you want to talk about?
How about those Mets?
That's
baseball.
That is baseball. I'm good on that conversation.
I'm going to let you lead, man. This is your world, man. I'm just so happy to be wallowing in it, as I always am. Our conversations have been one of the highlights of my measly little pallid existence.
I'm so happy to hear that. And whenever I hear like, "Hey, Ron wants to come on," I'm like, "Oh my god, it's great!" And people always love you're one of those guests where I will hear for months as the listeners kind of trickle in and listen at their convenience. Oh my god, Ron Perlman was fucking great on the podcast. You just have a thing. You have a nice thing.
Well, I didn't know what a podcast was till I met you.
That's right.
That was like. Like, remember I came in a suit and tie?
There's no cameras?
To my first one?
What is this?
Podcast. I better look nice for that. I comb my hair. I you know.
Now you're in a robe and a bathing suit.
I trimmed my nose hairs. I was rocking and rolling, man.
Let me ask you a question about nose hairs, because they do get worse.
Oh, my God. They do.
So
the other night, I sneezed.
Yep.
I whipped my entire family.
That's terrible. That's terrible. What a horrible thing to have. You gotta trim that down.
That's what happens when you get older.
That's what happens when you get older.
With the nose hairs.
But, you know, because I'm sure it's nice to hear that you're aware of it, because I'm sure you know people.
I'd be aware of it.
Well, because don't you know people that it's like,
sometimes
how can
you're
they not,
swallowing them.
How can you not see
with your
that
eggs
or
in the
ear hair or the nose hair? And it feels like, do people just not give a fuck or do they not?
That's what it is.
That's what it is.
Because by the time you get ear hair and nose hairs, you're already shitting yourself. So the last thing you are worried about is a little hair on your ears.
It's a good day if you only have that.
That's right.
And not.
That's right.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, you're cleaning the shit out of your pants, and you don't have to worry about harvesting your ear hair.
Yeah.
But do you find that, are you happier now in your 60s than you were when you were younger?
I'm happier. You're looking at a guy who can't be happier. I mean, I guess I could be. A little, but I am so happy. It's insane how happy I am, personally. My knees hurt so bad that it's a kind of a mixed happiness.
Oh, of course. Of course.
You know, I'm so sore all the time, but very much at peace. Very, 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 very. We never spent a podcast post book, the book I wrote.
No.
Did we?
No, I don't think so.
We should maybe, for the 10th anniversary of the book, we should set that up.
We're going to do that for the 10th anniversary.
Yeah.
What was the release date? Was it 2013 or something?
About 7 years ago.
So we're coming up. In 3 years, we'll do the 10th.
No, it was about 3 years ago. We have
7 years to go.
God only knows.
So right after.
What'll become of us? Think of the nose hair.
Listen, if there's even still going to be a fucking planet in 7 years, you know, that'll be nice.
Yeah.
That'll be a nice
thought. That's a fun conversation to have with your own kids.
No. Where should I go to college? May not matter. Maybe don't, you know.
There's going
to
be some beautiful oceanfront property in Utah.
That was Lex Luthor's whole plan in Superman.
Mm-hmm.
He bought all the Nevada coast. He bought all the land in Nevada, and he was going to sink California into the water, and then he was going to own all that beachfront property.
Those DC comic guys, man, they were prescient.
They figured it out early on.
Them and H.G. Wells.
Yeah, yes. Oh my! I just watched Time After Time again the other night. I love that movie.
Yeah.
Do you remember it, Malcolm McDowell, David Warner?
I do remember that movie. And I also remember having a conversation recently with somebody about the subject of Island of Dr. Moreau came up. I was in a version of that.
Yeah.
And by the time I was in my version of it, which is almost exactly 100 years to the day when he published the story.
Oh, wow.
Which you know, on a fantasy level, dealt with the notion of vivisection and gene splicing so that you could create a new breed of human,
mm-hmm.
which was a combination of human and animal.
Yep.
By the time we did our version of it, which was the third or fourth movie version of it, but the first time it was ever actually a reality.
Right.
where there was cloning and gene splicing.
This was the Brando version, right?
Yeah, this was, for lack of a better title.
This is the version where he was like, I want
And just to give you a little coming attraction.
Yep.
Teaser of what our book conversation will be like.
Yep.
I worked with Brando on that movie a total of 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And I turned it into 2 chapters in the book. I stretched that motherfucker out. You would think I spent 25 years with the fucking guy. Me and Marlon, that's what I should have called it.
5 days does feel like it could have felt like 25 years, though.
Well, you'll see. If you read the book, you'll see.
Well, just a little bit of a... How about just a little taste so people go, oh, I got to go read that. I got to go read those 2 chapters now in that book.
Whew. I mean, the stories are long, and they are long, which is why it wasn't hard to turn it into 2 chapters, because everything in those 2 chapters is absolutely word for word how it happened. But just a little tidbit.
Yeah.
I play this character called the Sayer of the Law, and whenever one of our experiments steps out of line, we have to have a trial. And the Sayer of the Law does these incantations, as written by H.G. Wells, reading the rules of what this new community of slash animal humans, not to walk on all fours, that is the law, not to slurp but sip, that is the law, and just this long incantation. And I'm stationed next to Dr. Moreau, who's, you know, in this case, judge, jury, and executioner for any of these experiments that dangerously steps out of line because of the amount of power, right? I decided to play the Sayer of the Law blind. And I went to the director and I got permission to play him blind. And I went to the makeup guys, Stan Winston's guys, because the makeup on this movie was like the thing.
Right.
And I said, I'd like to play him blind. Do you have these lenses that can make me look like milky and opaque? And they said, well, we have lenses, but they will unfortunately make you blind. They are completely opaque. And that's the only one we have that really looks like the real deal. I said, cool. And that was the like biggest acting mistake I've ever made in my life, because once you put them in, you had no idea whether you were in Poughkeepsie or you know, Siena, Italy.
Of course. And now you've committed to that.
And you've committed to that. And then I found out that I get nauseous every time I put them in and take them out. So I decided to just keep them in. Once they were in, I kept them in till lunch every day. And I would just find a rock to sit on my spot, which is on this rostrum adjacent to the Dr. Moreau, who's sitting in the throne conducting this trial. And so when Marlon Brando kept getting called back to the set, he had to walk around me because this rostrum was very small and he was 475 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
And he just, I would hear him mumble shit like, Jesus Christ, this fucking fat motherfucker. What the fuck? Excuse me, I'm trying. And he would like have to move around me.
Oh, no.
And because I just couldn't do anything but sit there. And for 5 days, this went down, right? And so on the fifth day, we were finally winding down. We were finally getting ready to shoot the last couple of shots of this sequence. They call him to the set, and I'm sitting on my little rock, completely blind. And he grabs me violently by both shoulders. And I go, ah! And I turn around, and I hear him say, what the fuck is in your eyes? And he says, wait a second. Are you playing him blind? And I go, you're fucking kidding me, right? You've been standing a foot and a half away from me for 5 days. You've been walking around me for 5 fucking days. You've been pissed off that I can't see you to help you get around me. And you're just figuring out. He goes, you're playing the Sayer of the Law. Blind, like justice is blind. I go, yeah. He goes, we got to start shooting the scene again. If I knew that, I would play it completely different.
Oh, shit.
So that's just a little tidbit.
And did you shoot the scene again?
No.
No.
The scene was supposed to take a day and a half to shoot it. We were on our fifth day. I mean, the studio was already pulling their hair out because, you know, everything was just complete clusterfuck.
But also, I mean, how do you have the presence of mind? Because I feel like most people, if Brando was like, "What the fuck are you doing?" You'd be like, "Mr. Brando, I'm so sorry." How do you have the gut to say to him, "Yeah, what the fuck have you been doing the last 5 days?" Like, how do you stand up to Brando?
I adored him so much. I mean, I just he was the only reason I was on the movie. I mean, at that point, I wasn't looking to put on makeup anymore. But to be in the presence of my God. I mean, he was, if you're a serious actor, you know, Brando is like Zeus,
right?
You know? And to be in a vicinity where you can watch his process.
Or hear it, in your case.
Find out. Yeah, hear it. I took myself right out of the fucking watching game, didn't I? I never realized that. That was like a really fucking stupid ass shit. But I was still able to be in his presence and watch or experience the guy who created Stanley Kowalski, the guy who created Terry Malloy, the guy who created Vito Corleone, who are, you know, those are three high water marks that will never be, ever be equaled or touched on any level. If you ask any actor, people don't know how he did those characters. He went deeper without ever violating what the writer had intended on its most primal level. So he was really a god. And, he could do no wrong. He fucked with me. You'll see this if you read the book. Initially, he fucked with me because he fucks with people a lot. He liked to fucking test out his environment. And he did that by testing the people who were around him to see what they were going to do, whether he could depend on them or not, or whether they were just going to be sycophantic Marlon.
Right.
You know? And he tested me. And for a couple of days, I was like heartbroken with the test that he pulled on me. And then I just said, "Fuck you, man. I'm here to do a job too." And from that point on, it got good.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess if you are someone, I think everyone really does need some kind of boundaries. I think people go crazy when they have zero boundaries. I think that's when people really go crazy. Like, you need, and if he has zero boundaries, then it's probably impossible for him to know how to live or relate to people or work or anything.
Well, he was brilliant. I mean, there were two sides of Marlon. You know, there was the side of him that he wanted to project to the world where he, you know, where am I? What am I supposed to be doing? I didn't really read the script. Tell me what's in it, you know. And then there was the actual side of him that read the script 25 fucking times and knew
right.
exactly where he was and what he wanted to do. And when you're Marlon Brando or Marilyn Monroe or a couple of other people that exist, Bob Dylan, there's not very many you can name who to the world are so unhuman because they're in such an incredibly vaulted position. You tend to create games for yourself to figure out who around me can I trust?
Yeah.
Who's just sucking my dick? You know, who's just like bullshitting me, you know, and who is like truly like would have my back if incoming started, you know, happening.
Right.
And that was my perception of why he was so good at this gamesmanship. And I say that because I was obsessed with figuring it out. I was obsessed with figuring out, like, what the fuck is your process, dude? Why can you do things that nobody else can do? You know, why are you Bob Dylan? Why are you Marilyn Monroe? Why do you have that gear that nobody else will ever have?
Did you figure it out?
No, but I approximated enough for me to say, okay, I had the Brando experience. And that's I'm not trying to sell copies of my book. Amazon /PX. No, there's no code.
PX90?
Just go to Amazon, look up Easy Street the Hard Way. Or not. I don't give a fuck.
A Ron Perlman.
I got
Ron Perlman book.
I don't want to, you know, I can't afford to be in a different tax bracket as it is.
Please don't buy the book. Pirate it if you can. It keeps me in a lower tax
bracket. Who wrote that book called Steal This Book If You Can?
Oh.
Jerry Rubin, right?
Was it?
It was one of the yuppies.
Can you look it up? Steal This Book If You Can. Yeah.
I think it was just called Steal This Book.
Abby Hoffman.
That was Jerry Rubin. They were buddies. They were best pals.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Abby Hoffman, Jerry Rubin. Yeah, they started the... What was the name of the organization? I should know this. This was my period.
Yeah, you clearly didn't steal that book.
Not only was my period, my exclamation point.
Hey, and guys, come on.
Now it's a question mark. I've gone through every form of punctuation.
And your colon.
When it comes to these things. Let's not discuss
now
the colon.
Now it's more of a semicolon.
You don't want to discuss the colon of a man my age. You think the nose hairs are taboo.
The nose hairs get longer, the colon gets shorter. That's how it is. You know. Yeah, I wonder if part of what happened... I mean, I know there's a whole other documentary about the making of that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if he was testing boundaries and people were just going, okay, let's let him change the story and the script and everything because they were too afraid to...
He never said a scripted word. Never. which you know, became problematic for those of us who were trying to, like, do take two.
Of course.
Our job is to match what we did in take one.
And he just says whatever comes to his...
And you have no idea, like, what it is you're playing to. It's because he's just...
Oh, I did that already. Let's see what else I can try.
But do you think there's a short... trip between, like, brilliant and just someone being an asshole? It's like brilliant and asshole.
Like I said, there were three times in his career where he nailed it.
Yeah.
Every other time was this guy fucking around. And those three times were Streetcar, On the Waterfront, and Godfather Part One. And I'm pretty sure in those three instances, he said every word that was scripted. And he immersed himself in those roles, and he did not fuck around or try to improve them. And all the other ones, he had not that kind of respect for. Well, this is my theory. I could be wrong. But, you know, on three occasions, he went so deep. It was like, you know, watching a Mickey Mantle home run, you know.
Right.
Like, holy shit, that's the stuff of legend right there. That's the stuff of... John Henry kind of shit.
Did he do the same thing on Apocalypse Now? Or was he just making shit up?
Was that your phone? That
I don't know. No, mine's off. That's yours.
I fucked up, didn't I?
I come to your podcast.
This time I didn't wear a shirt and tie. I knew better.
You look nice, though.
But I forgot to take my phone off.
You still look nice. Got a nice button-down shirt on.
Well, I did some on-camera stuff.
Oh, you did. You did on-camera stuff today, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have this new show.
Startup?
Debut, yes.
For Crackle?
For Crackle.
Fantastic.
I'll do anything. No, seriously, I'm pretty proud of this thing. Startup had one season without me.
Yeah.
Which was so phenomenal and such a strong ensemble that I even doubted why they thought they needed to augment it in any way, shape, or form. But, you know... The role that they offered me was quite layered, quite something I had never done before, which is kind of like my obsession these days is to just keep expanding, you know, like keep checking off, not bucket list, but, you know, this is a role I never did before. This is a psychology I've never kind of delved into before. And that's where all the fun is. And it's great writing, phenomenal ensemble. Adam Brody, Otmaro Marrero, Eddie Gathegi, and Martin Freeman. And this Thursday night, season two drops.
That's fantastic.
And I'm in that.
That's an incredible cast.
I'm in that motherfucker.
But I'm such a huge Martin Freeman fan, too. That guy's so good.
He's so good. He's in a class by himself, Martin Freeman. And when you watch his whole body of work, and then you watch season one of Startup, you don't realize he could be as dark as he is. And he is so dark in Startup. He is so compelling. And you like, no matter who else is on the screen, there's some great people on the screen with him. You just can't take your eyes off this guy.
Had you worked with him before?
Never worked with him before or met him before. And we don't work with each other in season two because we're in separate storylines, but hopefully.
So you still technically have not worked with him?
No. I'm still a bridesmaid.
Never a bride.
Never.
Never a bride.
But a person can develop a goal. Again, with the musical theater. What does that say about me?
Who did I watch? I went down a rabbit hole the YouTube rabbit hole, and I was watching Don Rickles roast Jerry Lewis.
It's really easy to go get onto the Don Lewis
fucking sidebar. Like, oh, I want to see him roast Carson now. I want to see him.
You just YouTube one Rickles thing.
Yeah.
And 3 days later, they're like slipping meals under the door to you. You know, like you're still watching.
I mean, it's the kind of killing where he's killing so hard that people are like slamming their hands on the dais. You know, like he's literally can say. I mean, seemed like the only guy that could actually insult Frank Sinatra, and Frank seemed to think it was amazing.
Well, you know the story, right?
What? Which one?
The Sinatra Don Rickles story.
No, I guess not.
So Rickles is at the Sands Hotel, guess in the either 50s or 60s, and he says, Frank, I'm seeing this girl tonight. I'm having dinner with her, and I'm on like third base. I'm really trying to close the deal. You're playing tonight. Could you stop by the restaurant around 8:45? Right? Just stop by the table. If she sees that I know you, boom, I'm in. She says, sure, Don, whatever. Sure enough, 8:45, Sinatra walks by the table. He says, hey, Don, how are you? Rickles looks up and he says, Frank, I'm eating.
He was such a fucking genius.
I don't think he ever wrote anything down. I think that he was one of those guys that lived right on the seat of his pants. I think that pretty much he took to the stage. He probably had some stuff that was planned out, but I think that pretty much almost everything he said and did was on the cuff.
Yeah, and he would never, unfortunately, he never wanted to do any sort of podcast to talk about any of this stuff because I guess he just thought, oh no, you just do comedy, you don't talk about it. However, I met him at a party, and it was at Craig Ferguson's house, and Craig introduced me to him and said, oh, Chris is a comic. And he was sitting in a chair, and he was like, oh, come down. So, like, I literally just knelt down, and he talked to me about comedy. And I just felt like saying, you're doing it now. Let's just record this. And it was so insightful. He was so sweet and warm and lovely.
How long before he had passed was this?
This was in 2010, I think. So it was a few handful of years.
Yeah.
It was a few years before he passed away.
Because I started to get to know him maybe around 2010, maybe a little earlier. And I kept seeing him in public all the way till the very end. And you could see the decline.
Yeah.
What I find with those guys is that they don't want to talk about a lot of things until they know that they're going home. And then that you can't stop them from talking about it. I found this to be true of a lot of people who, like, within 6 months of their, you know,
right,
passing on, would become, you know, just you couldn't shut them down and you couldn't stop them from talking about their lives and watching them cry and shit. Like, it's almost like they had to get it out before they.
The eerie thing about that is that their bodies seem to know. Yeah, that stuff weirds me out because I'm not religious in any way, and I don't believe in any kind of weird. I don't know. I don't believe in anything like that. But like 6 months before my dad had a heart attack and died, he started like getting all these pieces of his life in order. I mean, it just maybe it was a coincidence, but when I look at the timeline of everything in the last like handful of months of his life, it's eerie. Like all the things that he kind of went around in his life and wrapped up. Mm-hmm. And he was 72, perfectly, as far as he was concerned, healthy. Like didn't, you know, went to the doctor, had his gallbladder out, but that was it. But it almost makes me think like, oh my God, does your body know it's coming, you know, like before your brain has any concept of what's going to happen?
Yeah. No, I don't know if it's fair to tell the story. But Charles Durning, the great actor,
yeah,
was a heavily decorated veteran, landed on Omaha Beach, watched dozens of his guys go down, saved dozens of his guys, brought them to safety, got, you know, shrapneled up the ass, lived through it, got out, turned into an actor, and I got to know, you know, I knew him over the course of years, and whenever you brought up his military service, he would change the subject. He would just start telling jokes, because he was like, you would have loved him. He was like, he knew every joke ever told, and was happy to just sit there for 3 hours and just swap jokes with
Yeah.
And about 3-4 months before he went away, I was on a movie with him, and I would sit down in the chair while they were waiting, while we were waiting for them to light a shot, and he would just start talking about how he hasn't gotten through a night of sleep since 1944 without waking up and shuddering and crying in his wife's arms and she having to rock him back, and the price that he paid, but he kept it all in. And suddenly when he knew he was going home, he couldn't get it out fast enough.
Oh, wow.
And sure enough, and you know, and he would sit there. This was a brave dude. This was a real fucking OG. But he would sit there and shudder and cry and like all the guilt of like watching his friends go. And then whatever he had to do to just get on with his life and live a life and have a and have great humor and positivity, he went and did it. I mean, this is what Brokaw was talking about by The Greatest Generation. You know, those guys, those World War II guys. You never, if there was PTSD, I guess there was, but there was something about their makeup where they were able to just get on with it, get on with stuff. I'm sure that there were a lot of people. I'm sure I'm overgeneralizing. But it was insane. I mean, I felt so honored to be able to see this person who I already loved, who was desperate to sort of get his house in order emotionally.
Did he know he was dying, or was it fairly soon?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I think your dad did too.
They must have.
There's something that's going on that they're not letting on, but they know they're getting close to going home, and they start doing things that, you know, that are uncharacteristic with the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean 100% that it seemed like that, but maybe it's that last, you know, your body, you know, hey, I need to be heard and I need my story out in the world before I go, because it just needs to, you know, it's mm-hmm. that need to spread your, you know, like your emotional DNA, I guess, for lack.
I don't think it was that with Charlie. I think it was just unburdening what he was, what
so he
was,
could go,
what he was, you know, holding in, and you know, obviously the price of him holding it, and nobody knew about it except his wife on those, you know, night after night, her having to, like, you know, rock him back to sleep.
Yeah.
I just think he needed to unburden himself. I just think he needed to get right, you know, get right with it all. And there's a spirituality to that, that leads me to believe personally that there's more to heaven and earth that are dreamed of in our philosophies, young Horatio.
I hope that's the case. I really want that. That would be great. That would be great.
Well, if I get there, I'll send you a tweet.
I feel like you'll outlive everybody.
Stay by the Twitter machine.
I think you'll outlive everybody. You'll be like 150-year-old Ron Perlman.
Look, Ron died 3 weeks ago. Look, I got a tweet from him. I got a DM from him. It's just a picture of nose hairs.
It's just like Rapunzel style, just as just unfurled all around, just wrapped up. How was Don the last few years?
Rickles,
yeah.
Well, he was beautiful. Whenever I would see him, he would just, like, you know, I would get 10 minutes unsolicited. You know, it's like, he would roast me. I mean, it was beautiful to be roasted by Don Rickles.
Oh my God!
Nobody knew about it but me and a couple of the friends I was with and him. You know, it was not done in the Friars Club or, you know, on Dean Martin's, you know,
right,
like in the light of day. But I got fucking roasted by Rickles, man.
That's pretty huge.
And I mean, the first time I ever engaged with him in a restaurant here in L.A., I walked over to his table. It was my 60th birthday. And I was out with a few of the guys and stuff, and we saw Rickles. It was like 11 o'clock. Everybody in the restaurant had gone home except his table and ours. And we pay our check, and I, as I'm walking out, I said to my guys, I said, I got to fucking say hello to Rickles, right? It's my birthday. I mean, I get to do whatever I want, right? So I walk halfway across the floor, and as I get halfway across, I said, excuse me, Mr. Rickles, may I approach? And between there and me getting to the table, he fucking roasted me.
That's fantastic.
He went through like 20 years of my career.
Oh, he knew you?
Completely. And he ended up by saying, this is a man who will do anything for money. Because he listed all these really lame projects that he knew about. And I turned to my guys and I said, I can die satisfied.
That was it. That's all you needed.
I've been roasted by the best in the business.
On your 60th birthday.
And then I kept running into him in restaurants like that. I remember we were in a different restaurant. It was like Father's Day. And my family was taking me out. And at the next table, there was like 25 seats. They like put a bunch of tables together. Huge party. And as I... You know, I took a glance over and I see all the way in the corner among these 35 Jews, you know, is Rickles. And I go, hey, Don, happy Father's Day. He goes, hey, how are you? I said, your family? He says, no, they kidnapped me. Call the police. Nobody at the table was laughing. Nobody at that table got it except me and my family.
It's so interesting to me that like Rickles and Joan Rivers, like two people who had very caustic senses of humor, were two of the loveliest, sweetest human beings.
Well, you find that about comics. I mean, comics are the most sensitive, you know, people who like feel things deeper than everybody else.
Of course.
And that's where all the humor comes from. And you know, that's where the gallows humor comes from. Great comics, man, are the most feelingful, sensitive people who've ever lived. And being funny was their defense mechanism.
Yeah.
Was to their survival tactic, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's funny now when you see, if you see a young person hear an older person's joke and go, oh, you can't say that, that's offensive. Like, oh, you haven't been kicked around enough. Just wait. I think this is funny in like 20 years.
Yeah. Oh.
Is that where your sense of humor comes from?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's very, very highly chronicled in the book, too. I mean, we may as well just segue right into the book right now. fuck the tax bracket. Let me sell a couple of books. No.
You should sell a couple of books.
It's very much so, you know. Not to belabor it, but yeah.
How much do you work versus, I mean, do you try to work nonstop all year, or do you like work a little bit and then like take time off?
I'm working a lot now, and I'm enjoying the shit out of myself because I'm only doing things I love.
Yep.
And there are so many things that are coming at me that are really interesting and really good. You know, I started my own film studio, so we've produced 7 movies in the last 3 years.
Jesus.
And basically it was always a fantasy of mine to be the shot caller, to be the guy who picked what we're going to spend money on making.
Yep.
And I made a few mistakes in the early going, you know, because I wanted to just join the club.
Sure.
But lately, I'm only greenlighting stuff that I think is just fucking mind-bendingly interesting and original and great. And sometimes I'm in some of that stuff. Sometimes I'm just producing it. But I'm having a ball. I do like, after a heavy-duty gig, a couple-of-week breather, because you just got to recharge the battery and clean the palate and stuff. And I finally learned after all these years how to do nothing and be happy.
Oh, how do you do that? What is it? What's the secret?
Well, I think it's basically just, you know, you grow older. I mean, I don't think there's any big secret to it. You just grow older and you just start liking your own company more, and you just don't need to be animated in order to be happy.
Oh yeah, I think that's it. It's not the desperate need for attention or the desperate need for constant stimulation.
Yeah. Or distraction, because, you know, when you're working, it's the ultimate distraction. You don't have to worry about any of the realities of your life.
Right.
You know, like your accountant is and your wife is and your children are. You know, you're just in some, like, never land, you know,
right.
with Tinkerbell, you know, and like of the boy who never had to grow up. So working, especially in our business, is a state of grace. It's like, you know, it's like a deferment from the bullshit, you know?
Right?
Which is why we love to work so much.
What are some of the things that you're producing right now that your studio is producing?
So I just produced two back-to-back movies in New York. One is called To Dust.
Okay.
With Matthew Broderick and Geza Rohrig, the actor who was in Son of Saul.
Uh-huh.
And then I produced a movie called Asher, which I star in, directed by Michael Keaton Jones. And that had Famke Johnson, Richard Dreyfuss, Jacqueline Bisset, Peter Fascinelli, my brain is fried right now, but there's just nothing but great actors in that.
Richard Dreyfuss seems like the greatest guy.
He's really, really, really a very, very down-to-earth, warm, loving human who you can't love the business any more than he does, and who, so, you know, if I ask him a question about, hey, on the set of Close Encounters, there was that one day, he will fucking regale you. and for me, who's like a film freak, being regaled by that guy, who's arguably been in some of the, you know, coolest movies of all time, I'm in heaven.
That's fantastic.
And we got to be, you know, I hadn't met him before. We'd been in the same room before on a couple of occasions, but here we were working head-to-head for a few days. And I actually consider him a friend. I mean, he's so warm and generous and huggable.
That's nice. That's nice to hear.
Yeah.
Because I think you know, hearing that someone whose work you respect ends up happy or is a good person or isn't jaded by the whole thing, it's kind of a nice roadmap. So you can go, oh, yeah, it's possible to not, you don't have to turn into a bitter pile of ashes.
Yeah, no, he's aging quite gracefully, and he seems to have a great deal of joie de vivre still intact.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
My ex-girlfriend from 10 years ago went to see a screening of Tootsie at the Cinerama Dome, and it was for this part of this film festival, and Dustin Hoffman was there, and he spoke after the movie, and she said it was like the greatest, because he was so... He wasn't dismissive of it at all. Like, he just loved it and embraced it and had great stories.
Yeah.
And that makes you, I don't know, it makes me happy to think that, oh, okay, this wasn't just a... Because sometimes you meet people go, ah, it's just a job. You go, that's it? Yeah, it's just a job.
Yeah,
all right.
Those people are full of shit.
Okay, good.
I'm telling you, man. I'm telling you, you know, they'll say it, but don't believe them.
Okay.
Because if they really do mean that, they got no fucking right being in this business.
Right.
Yeah. Fuck you. This is a fucking privilege, man.
Did you ever?
We are standing. I said this many times. I'll say it again. I probably even said it on the Nerdist. But we are standing on the shoulders of geniuses. Anybody who's in this business right now.
Yeah.
And if you don't get that, if you don't get how, you know, rarefied the air is that you're breathing as a working entertainer in the film business, fuck you.
Yeah.
Fuck you.
That needs to be your Twitter bio. That's the bio.
Oh, no. I tweeted that out 17 times already today alone. I'm a very angry guy. You know that
he
about me.
He says with
me.
A smile.
You know that about me.
I mean,
I got a lot of reasons to be angry.
Is there a... I mean, it... You know,
we've covered some of them.
We've covered just a few of them, but there's still so much more. That's
oh my
why this
God,
is a special seven-part podcast.
It's unending. It's unending. It's infinite.
Do you
it's
think
quicksand.
Do you think it's good to have social media for you, or do you feel like, I don't know, I'm spending a lot of energy on something that maybe isn't? Because, you know, you get upset and you go, okay, well, I'm just going to go tweet this out because I'm pissed off about something. Is that healthy, or do you think that that's not healthy?
I'm trying to make my peace with that right now. You know, I know I do it to a degree that can easily be considered unhealthy, even by myself.
Sure.
The fact of the matter is, though, like if you had told me 10 years ago, Twitter? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And now I'm like the fucking Twitter king. I mean, I'm just like, I can't stop myself, you know. Number one, I'm obsessed with the world in which I live. And Twitter is the fastest communicator of what exactly is going down. The minute somebody dies, like I knew Prince died the minute it happened.
Right.
He went like this. Boom. Trent. Somebody tweeted,
yeah.
You know, RIP Prince.
Right.
Artist. You know, so it's good for that. But also, we are really in a period right now where I feel like we've lost our way in so many ways. And I feel like we've gotten so far away from our better angels. And I'm not saying this blanketly because I think that there's tremendous amount of good in the world. But the tail that's wagging the dog right now is fucking corrupt and fucked up has a stench to it that is outrageous, and that is co-opting our better angels, and that is becoming normalized and desensitizing and all those things. And I feel as though, as a father of two, who basically has had a great life, and I don't need to, you know, worry about me anymore. What I do need to worry about is the world that I'm passing on to my kids, and hopefully their kids, if there is a world for their kids, that I have to participate, and I have to be vocal, and I have to make sure I fought as hard as I fucking could for the things that I think are important. I say that unapologetically, and it took me a while to get there because you take so much incoming, you know, like,
you're an actor, stay in your fucking lane. Who gives a shit? Just tell jokes,
right.
You cocksucker.
This is affecting people who normally wouldn't be speaking up. And it's affecting the quality of our very existence. It's a threat to, you know, the fundamental tenets of democracy. It's a threat to our First Amendment. It's a threat to any semblance of decency. It's horrific. And I would never be able to live with myself unless I felt like I was doing every single thing I could to stand for what I think is important.
And that's that's helped you a lot.
No, but that's the takeaway. When you ask me like about my overall outlook.
Yeah, but social media has helped you a lot with that,
I'm using it
20 years ago.
Like, I mean, I'm using it very, very proactively as a way for me to articulate to myself, number one, like what do I truly believe in? And then if I feel strongly about it, I share it with the world.
When people say, fuck you, you're an actor, shut up, you dumb cocksucker, whatever, do you engage with them or do you just go, unfollow, you know, do you kind of just kind of spiritually go, unfollow me if you don't like it? I give a shit.
Well, if 300 people say it to me, I engage with maybe one or two. And then I let them,
like, you let them fight it out?
You know, place tab A into slot B. You know, like it's like IKEA. You know, just go back to the original five instructions.
Right.
Which is go fuck yourself. You just put a fucking reality show clown into the highest office in the land, and you're telling me I don't have a right. Who combs his hair the way he does, and you're telling me I don't have a right to fucking have an opinion?
Right.
Are you kidding me?
Well, yeah, that's it. You know, yeah, it is kind of interesting. You know, people say they want to. I don't know. It's just such a strange period for humanity, and I just
and the planet.
Yeah, but I mean, just
and our safety.
But I mean, even with the way that we engage with the internet and the way that we engage with one another, I worry for humanity sometimes because it's just so. It can be as much as we feel like, oh, we're all coming together. I feel like the manner in which we interact is actually incredibly isolating, and I think is very, very dangerous for people.
Yeah, it's very it's you know, in my book. Oh, never mind.
Interesting. Where was that? Is that one? Amazon? Were you able to find that Amazon?
You can get it on Amazon. Funny you should ask.
Oh, interesting. I was just taking a guess.
Take a gander. What else? What isn't available on Amazon?
I mean, literally.
I think that's where he got his cabinet. And it wasn't even Prime. He was just on the regular site.
Just got the regular delivery. They're not going to pay for Prime. Come on.
Ah, look what we got. Mnuchin.
I mean, Amazon.
Price.
Amazon, I wonder, at some point, someone's going to break that company up, right? Like, it's just too, it's a lot. Amazon is a lot of everything. Is that, is it like an antitrust situation?
I mean, you're talking about, you know, a world order. I mean, count me out. Count me out of that discussion.
By the way, I've been welcoming it. I love that I can just go get literally anything on Amazon. Convenience is really the enemy of progress.
I still like the bricks and mortar. I still like going to the store to buy my groceries and going to... that's about it. I get everything else on Amazon.
You could get groceries, too, if you want.
I know I could, but you can't squeeze the plum.
No, you can't. No, that's true. You can't squeeze the plum.
No.
You know what happens sometimes is if we're really busy, we'll order stuff to get delivered. And, like, I eat bananas all the time. And, like, 8 times out of 10, the bananas show up, and they're just, like, a solid green. I'm like, yeah. Oh, man! Yeah. It's the most privileged problem in the world. I wanted to eat this banana now! Now I gotta wait 3 days. If I'd just gone to the fucking store, I could have picked my own banana.
Exactly. And eaten it right there in the store.
I could have eaten it in the store. I'm not a... Wait, are you someone... You ever see people, like, eating the shit they haven't bought yet? I always felt like that's a violation. Like, you're not supposed to do that. Are you?
You're not supposed to do that.
Are you an eater before you buy?
All the time.
Okay, good.
I've opened, you know, jars of peanut butter
and said
to the person who's stocking the shelves, you got a spoon on you?
Yeah, let's go. Spoons are aisle 4. Okay, great. Thanks.
Thanks, pal.
So then you're using a spoon that you haven't bought yet to eat peanut butter you haven't bought yet.
Yeah, but I'm good for it. I'll take those things to the checkout station.
They'll get checked out.
And like I've been shopping in my local stores for so long that they don't worry about me.
That's nice.
They go, yeah, Ron, Ronnie.
Hey, Ronnie.
He's going to pay for it.
Ronnie can open the peanut butter in the aisle. It's okay. He's good for it. Ronnie's good for it.
But, you know, not everybody can get away with that shit, so don't be like me.
What do people say to you when they come up? I assume people come up to you and go, hey, what do they say?
After that, nothing.
That's it. And then they just walk away.
They just give me a hey. I have a thing where I play a game when I out of the corner of my eye, if I see somebody make me, you know, like, oh, my God. I have a little game. That by the time they actually recognize me and walk up to me, what project are they gonna?
How right are you most of the time?
I'm usually right about 98% of the time. And you know, it's really easy to tell when the person's gonna say, Police Academy 7. And there's more of those than you can fucking imagine.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure you still get Beauty and the Beast. I'm sure.
Not that much.
Not as much anymore.
A lot of Sons of Anarchy.
Sons of Anarchy is the
Hellboy, big Hellboy, Hellboy, up the wazoo. And occasionally, like, you'll see somebody who's complete, like, you know, you'll say, oh, he went to Yale. It's either going to be Name of the Rose or City of Lost Children.
Oh, wow.
And I'm right. Like 98% of the time.
Well, you've done so many different kinds of things. I'm sure they could form a psychological profile around the movies that a person would recognize you from. Like, oh, if you like these types of movies, you are probably this type of person.
Yeah, and you know, it's like, you know, it's like people actually look exactly like they're supposed to when they've just committed the most heinous crime. You get their mugshot, and they go, of course that person just walked into a church.
That tracks.
That was like an accident waiting to happen.
You mentioned Name of the Rose, which I remember that movie from when I was in high school. I remember watching that movie. And I just became pals with Christian Slater, and he's fucking rad.
Yeah, he's good dude.
He's so funny and cool.
That was his debut, man, pretty much.
Yeah, well, his mom was a casting director.
His mom cast me in a bunch of stuff at New York long before Christian was even born. And so she and I were kind of like tight. And then she gets, you know, she hears that I get on the movie and, you know, she says, keep your eye on my boy, will you? And I didn't want to tell her that, you know, it was impossible to find him because I won't say why. But
for reasons.
For reasons. He was very popular.
He's such a nice guy.
He's such, such a nice guy, and I'm so happy that he's found this very unique success with the robot thing.
Yeah. What else are you working on now?
Me?
Yeah, you got startup. You got this book that's a couple years old. You almost have to write a new book, by the way.
You know, the funny thing is, this is how old I am. About a month ago, I'm working out in the gym. And I already know now that whenever I have a good idea, I need to write it down. Because in 2 minutes, it's gone. And I had the idea for my next book. And I was never going to write a second book unless I had such a cool idea that I had to write it. And I had the idea.
Oh, fuck.
I can't remember what it is.
God damn it.
But when I do.
Oh, that's just going to be in search of that next book.
So what am I doing? I produced all those movies. I'm producing more. I got more and more movies up in the pipeline. I'm doing the show for Crackle, which I love, which we go back into production in Puerto Rico, by the way, which is where we shoot in January. If they're back up on their feet again, I hope. And that's it. That's it, man.
And then the rest of the time, you're just
living off the fat of the land,
chilling and being happy to be
trying to have
Ronnie
great
Perlman.
Conversations like this with people who I have great conversations with.
I mean, I saw you at that premiere last year for Fantastic Beasts.
Yeah,
and Where to Find Them, and these types of events are very stressful to me because I still feel like I don't belong there, and it's weird, and I still don't feel comfortable. And so when I see someone that I like and that I know, and I saw you on the red car, I'm like, oh my God!
Yeah.
And I think there's pictures of me actually just hugging you because I was so happy.
There are. I bought those pictures.
Like a lifeline.
Very wonderful pictures.
I really appreciate it. And and now that, we're kind of neighbors, you really should just come over and hang out from time to time.
It's really nice to be here with you, man.
You need to come back and hang out.
It's a cool spot.
Socially. Thank you so
much.
I'm
not going to blow up your spot by talking about how amazing the house I'm sitting in is, but it is quite amazing.
It's fun. We had some fun.
What year was this house built?
29.
Mine was 26.
Nice.
Yeah.
It was a good year. Like, they really...
A good decade for building, especially Spanish.
Yes. In this part of the country that's kind of Spanish.
Yeah. And they built the shit out of homes back then, too. This is, like, solid.
We found, when we were just doing some restoration of the house, we found these really amazing things. And to the extent that it kind of made me want to open up all the walls, but we didn't. But we found, like... old strips of old newspapers.
There was one wall you opened up where you found Geraldo Rivera, right?
He was in there holding Al Capone's treasure.
He was, these are Al Capone's balls.
They were in your walls the whole time. I've been trapped in here the whole time.
Whoever thought he would put his balls up here?
Well, that's the magic of it, is no one would have guessed. But here they are.
Good idea.
And we have them.
It's a good idea.
But we found like cool stuff in the ceilings and the walls, and
I'll bet. And
it just makes me want to. Have you ever done renovations?
We're about to renovate my house. This is a long-standing dream of mine, and I keep putting it off and putting it off. But we're finally, it's upon us.
Nice.
I don't think I want to be around to see what's in my walls.
Well, you don't want to. You know, we lived here while it was happening, and I don't recommend that.
No,
but
I'm moving out. But we're doing a complete, like, from street to street.
Are you gonna restore it to its original kind of state?
We are going to definitely not only try to keep it in the exact same flavor it
is,
but we're going to try to enhance it even more and make it, go all the way with the style that it was intended to be. Because it kind of falls between a kind of a Mediterranean and a Spanish.
Yep.
And we're also adding a huge amount of space onto it.
That's cool.
So all the fantasy stuff that I wanted in the house. I love the location. I love the neighborhood. I love the street. And instead of going and trying to find some other new place, I'm just going to give the house all this love it's always given me.
That's cool, because I really when you see like an old Spanish house and then you look inside and someone's like totally modernized it kind of breaks my heart a little bit. Like, no,
yeah, no, no,
don't
no.
Buy a Spanish house if you're going to do that. Just go get a modern glass cube.
Exactly. No, I mean, I'm just a complete esoteric sucker for the warmth of Spanish.
Yes.
You know, the tiles, the colors that are indicative of,
and the attention to detail, yeah, of like
all of the ironwork,
yeah,
all of the woodwork, you know, that's juxtaposed in a gray Spanish, like hacienda kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's my favorite kind of architecture, so we're going to double down on all that.
Yeah, and you in these old houses, you can tell so many of the that all the detailing was like, well, they had to do it by hand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was one of the mirror. We have these sliding glass doors upstairs, these closet doors, and sadly, one of them got misplaced during the restoration process. So we had to make another one, and the process by which they etched the glass, like no one even does it anymore.
Right,
and the tile that we tried to match. It's very the process to make it the tile a certain color with a certain glaze they can't do anymore because of course it's horribly toxic, but you know it's like just the processes, there right. was so much artistry, you know, there was so much artistry yeah. in it.
It's almost easier to just replace it all with something instead of trying to duplicate it.
Well, it's almost impossible to duplicate. You know, we did the best. I think we did a pretty good job, but it was it's very hard when you realize.
From what I've seen, this house is spectacular.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Well, we'll wrap up the podcast and I'll show you around a little bit.
Oh,
and then
great.
you got to come back.
Beautiful.
Wow. Ron Perlman. Nerds Podcast. Enjoy your burrito, everyone. The end.
Now leaving nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.